located between his camp and the town, with 4 legions and all the cavalry, and marched against Fabius's 2 legions. When his approach was announced, Lucius Plancus, who had the command of those legions, compelled by the emergency, took post on a rising ground, and drew up his army with 2 fronts, that it might not be surrounded by the cavalry. Thus, though engaged with superior numbers, he sustained the furious charge of the legions on the horse. When the battle was begun by the horse, there were observed at a distance by both sides the colors of 2 legions, which Caius Fabius had sent around by the further bridge to reinforce our men, suspecting, as the event proved, that the enemy's generals would take advantage of the opportunity which fortune had put in their way to attack our men. Their approach put an end to the battle, and each general led back his legions to their respective camps. 2 days later I came to the camp with 900 horse, which I had retained for a bodyguard. The bridge which had been broken down by the storm was almost repaired, and I ordered it to be finished in the night. Being acquainted with the nature of the country, I left behind 6 cohorts to guard the bridge, the camp, and all my baggage, and the next day set off in person for Ilerda, with all my forces drawn up in 3 lines. We halted just before the camp of Afranius, and having remained there a short time under arms, I offered him battle on equal terms. When this affair was made, Afranius drew out his forces and posted them on the middle of a hill, near the camp. When I perceived that Afranius declined coming to an engagement, I resolved to encamp at somewhat less than 1/2 mile's distance from the very foot of the mountain. So my soldiers, while engaged in their works, might not be terrified by any sudden attack of the enemy or disturbed in their work, I ordered them not to fortify with a wall, which must rise high and be seen at a distance, but draw on the front opposite the enemy, a trench 15 feet broad. The 1st and 2nd lines were confined under arms, as was from the first appointed. Behind them the 3rd line was carrying on the work without being seen, so that the whole was completed before Afranius discovered that the camp was being fortified. In the evening I drew my legions within this trench, and rested them under arms the next night. The next day I kept my whole army within it, and as it was necessary to bring materials from a considerable distance, for the moment I pursued the same plan in my work, and to each legion, one after the other, I assigned 1 side of the camp to fortify, and ordered trenches of the same magnitude to be cut. I kept the rest of the legions under arms without baggage to oppose the enemy. Afranius and Petreius, to frighten us and obstruct the work, drew out their forces at the very foot of the mountain, and challenged us to battle. I, however, did not interrupt my work, relying on the protection of the 3 legions, and the strength of the fosse. After staying for a short time and advancing no great distance from the bottom of the hill, the forces were led back to camp. The 3rd day I fortified my camp with a rampart, and ordered the other cohorts which I had left in the upper camp and my baggage to be removed to it. Between the town of Ilerda and the next hill, on which Afranius and Petreius were encamped, there was a plain about 300 paces broad, and near the middle of it an eminence somewhat raised above the level. I hoped that if I could get possession of this and fortify it, I should be able to cut off the enemy from the town, the bridge, and all the supplies which they had laid up in the town. In expectation of this I led 3 legions out of the camp, and drawing up my army in an advantageous position, I ordered the advanced men of 1 legion to hasten forward and seize the eminence. Upon learning of this, the cohorts which were on guard before Afranius's camp were instantly sent a closer way to occupy the same post. The 2 parties engaged, and as Afranius's men had reached the eminence first, our men were repulsed, and on a reinforcement being sent, they were obliged to turn their backs and retreat to the standards of legions. The manner of fighting of those soldiers was to run forward with great impetuosity, and boldly take a post, and not to keep their ranks strictly, but to fight in small scattered parties. If hard pressed, they thought it no disgrace to retire and give up the post, being accustomed to this manner of fighting among the Lusitanians and other barbarous nations, because it commonly happens that soldiers are strongly influenced by the customs of those countries in which they've spent a lot of time. This method, however, alarmed our men, who were not used to such a method of warfare. They imagined that they were about to be surrounded on their exposed flank by the single men who ran forward from their ranks, and they thought it their duty to keep their ranks and not to quit their colors, nor, without good reason, to give up the post which they had taken. Accordingly, when the advanced guard gave way, the legion which was stationed on that wing did not keep its ground, but retreated to the next hill. Almost the whole army being daunted by this, because it had occurred contrary to their expectations and custom, I encouraged my men, and led the 9th Legion to their relief, and checked the insolent and eager pursuit of the enemy, and obliged them in their turn to show their backs and retreat to Ilerda, and take post under the walls. But the soldiers of the 9th Legion, being overzealous to repair the dishonor which had been sustained, having rashly pursued the fleeing enemy, advanced into disadvantageous ground, and went up to the foot of the mountain on which the town Ilerda was built. And when they wished to retire, they were again attacked by the enemy from the rising ground. The place was craggy in the front, and steep on either side, and was so narrow that even 3 cohorts drawn up in order of battle would fill it. But no relief could be sent on the flanks, and the horse could be of no service to them when hard-pressed. From the town, even the precipice inclined with a gentle slope for near 400 paces. Our men had to retreat this way, as they had, through their eagerness, advanced too inconsiderately. The greatest contest was in this place, which was much to the disadvantage of our troops, both on account of its narrowness and because they were posted at the foot of the mountain, so that no weapon was thrown at them without effect, yet they exerted their valor and patience and bore every wound. The enemy's forces were increasing, and cohorts were frequently sent to their aid from the camp through the town, that fresh men might relieve the weary. I was obliged to do the same, and relieve the fatigued by sending cohorts to that post. After the battle had in this manner continued incessantly for 5 hours, and our men had suffered much from superior numbers, having used up all their javelins, they drew their swords, and charged the enemy up the hill, and having killed a few, obliged the rest to flee. The cohorts being beaten back to the wall, and some being driven by their fears into the town, an easy retreat was afforded to our men. Our cavalry also, on either flank, though stationed on sloping or low ground, yet bravely struggled up to the top of the hill, and riding between the two armies made our retreat more easy and secure. Such were the various turns of fortune in this battle. In the first encounter about 70 of our men fell, among them Quintus Fulgenius, 1st centurion of the 2nd line of the 14th Legion, who, for his extraordinary valor, had been promoted from the lower ranks to that post. About 600 were wounded. Of Afranius's party there were killed Titus Caecilius, principal centurion, and 4 other centurions, and over 200 men. But an opinion was spread about concerning this day, that each party thought they had come off conquerors. Afranius's soldiers, because though they were esteemed inferior in the opinion of all, yet they had withstood our attack and sustained our charge, and at first had kept the post on the hill which had been the occasion of the dispute, and in the first encounter had obliged our men to fly. But ours, because notwithstanding the disadvantage of the ground and the disparity of numbers, they had maintained the battle for 5 hours, had advanced up the hill, swords in hand, and had forced the enemy to fly from the higher ground and driven them into the town. The enemy fortified the hill, about which the contest had been, with strong works, and posted a garrison on it. 2 days after this altercation, there happened an unexpected misfortune. So great a storm arose that it was agreed that there were never seen higher floods in those countries. It swept down the snow from all the mountains, and broke over the banks of the river, and in one day carried away both the bridges which Fabius had built, a circumstance which caused great difficulties to my army, for as our camp, as already mentioned, was pitched between two rivers, the Segre and Cinca, and as neither of these could be forded for the space of 30 miles, we were all of necessity confined within these narrow limits. Neither could the states which had espoused my cause furnish me with corn, nor could the troops return who had gone far to forage, as they were stopped by the waters. Nor could the convoys coming from Italy and Gaul make their way to the camp. And it was the most distressing season of the year, when there was no corn in the blade, and it was nearly ripe. And the states were exhausted because Afranius had conveyed almost all the corn, before my arrival, into Ilerda, and whatever I had left had been already consumed by us. The cattle, which might have served as a secondary resource against shortages, had been removed by the states to a great distance on account of the war. Those who had gone out to get forage or corn were chased by the light troops of the Lusitanians and the targeteers of hither Spain, who were well acquainted with the country, and could readily swim across the river, because it was the custom of all those people not to join their armies without bringing their own flotation devices. But Afranius's army had abundance of everything. A great stock of corn had been provided and laid in long before. A large quantity was coming in from the whole province. They had a good supply of forage. The bridge of Ilerda afforded an opportunity of getting all this without any danger, and the places beyond the bridge, to which I had no access, were as yet untouched. These floods continued several days. I endeavored to repair the bridges, but the height of the water did not allow me, and the cohorts dispatched along the banks did not suffer them to be completed. And it was easy for them to prevent it, both from the nature of the river and the height of the water, but especially because their darts were thrown from the whole course of the bank on one confined spot, and it was no easy matter at the same time to execute a work in a very rapid flood and to avoid the darts. Intelligence was brought to Afranius that the great convoys which were on their march to me had halted at the river. Archers from the Ruthini and cavalry from the Gauls, with a long train of baggage, according to the Gallic custom of traveling, had arrived there. There were with them about 6,000 people of all descriptions, with slaves and freedmen, but there was no order or regular discipline, as everyone followed their own humor, and all traveled without apprehension, taking the same liberty as on former marches. There were several young noblemen, sons of senators and of equestrian rank. There were ambassadors from several states, there were lieutenants of mine. The river stopped them all. To attack us by surprise, Afranius set out in the beginning of the night, with all his cavalry and 3 legions, and sent the horse on before, to fall on them by surprise. But the Gallic horse soon got themselves in readiness and attacked them. Though only a few, they withstood the vast number of the enemy, as long as they fought on equal terms. But when the legions began to approach, having lost a few men, there was a retreat to the next mountains. The delay occasioned by this battle was of great importance to the security of our men, for having gained time, they retired to the higher grounds. There were missing that day about 200 bowmen, a few horse, and an inconsiderable number of servants and baggage. For all these reasons, however, the price of provisions was raised, which is commonly a disaster attendant not only on a time of present scarcity, but on the apprehension of future shortages. Provisions had now reached 50 denarii per bushel, and the shortage of corn had diminished the strength of the soldiers, and the inconveniences were increasing every day, and so great an alteration was wrought in a few days, and fortune had so changed sides, that our men had to struggle with the shortage of every necessity, while the enemy had an abundant supply of all things, and were considered to have the advantage. I demanded from those states which had acceded to my alliance a supply of cattle, as they had but little corn. I sent away the camp followers to the more distant states, and endeavored to remedy the present scarcity by every resource in my power. Afranius and Petreius and their friends sent fuller and more circumstantial accounts of these things to Rome and to their acquaintances. Reports exaggerated them so that the war appeared to be almost at an end. When these letters and dispatches were received at Rome, a great concourse of people resorted to the house of Afranius, and congratulations ran high. Several went out of Italy to Cneius Pompey, some of them to be the first to bring him the intelligence, others that they might not be thought to have waited out the issue of the war and come last of all. With my affairs in this unfavorable position, and all the passes guarded by the soldiers and horse of Afranius, and the bridges unable to be prepared, I ordered my soldiers to make ships of the kind that my knowledge of Britain a few years before had taught me. First the keels and ribs were made of light timber, then the rest of the hulk of the ships was wrought with wicker work and covered with hides. When these were finished, I drew them down to the river in wagons in one night, a distance of 22 miles from my camp, and transported in them some soldiers across the river, and quickly took possession of a hill adjoining the bank. This I immediately fortified before I was sighted by the enemy. To this I afterward transported a legion, and having begun a bridge on both sides, I finished it in 2 days. By this means I brought safely to my camp the convoys, and those who had gone out to forage, and began to prepare a conveyance for the provisions. The same day I made a great part of my cavalry pass the river, who, falling on the foragers by surprise as they were dispersed without any suspicions, intercepted an incredible number of cattle and people, and when some Spanish light-armed cohorts were sent to reinforce the enemy, our men judiciously divided themselves into 2 parts, the one to protect the spoil, the other to resist the advancing foe and to beat them back. They cut off from the rest and surrounded one cohort, which had rashly ventured out of the line before the others, and after putting it to the sword, returned safe with considerable booty to the camp over the same bridge. While these affairs were going forward at Ilerda, the Massilians, adopting the advice of Domitius, prepared 17 ships of war, of which 11 were decked. To these they added several smaller vessels, that our fleet might be terrified by numbers. They manned them with a great number of archers and of the Albici, of whom mention has already been made, and these they incited by rewards and promises. Domitius required certain ships for his own use, which he manned with colonists and shepherds, whom he had brought along with him. A fleet being thus furnished with every necessity, he advanced with great confidence against our ships, commanded by Decimus Brutus. It was stationed at an island opposite to Massilia. Brutus was much inferior in number of ships, but I had appointed to that fleet the bravest men selected from all my legions, Antesignani and centurions, who had requested to be employed in that service. They had provided iron hooks and harpoons, and had furnished themselves with a vast number of javelins, darts, and missiles. Thus prepared, and being apprised of the enemy's approach, they put out from the harbor and engaged the Massilians. Both sides fought with great courage and resolution, nor did the Albici, a hardy people, bred on the highlands, and inured to arms, fall much short of our men in valor, and being lately come from the Massilians, they retained in their minds their recent promises, and the wild shepherds, encouraged by the hope of liberty, were eager to prove their zeal in the presence of their masters. The Massilians themselves, confiding in the quickness of their ships and the skill of their pilots, eluded ours, and evaded the shock, and as long as they were permitted by clear space, lengthening their line, they endeavored to surround us, or to attack single ships with several of theirs, or to run across our ships and carry away our oars if possible. But when necessity obliged them to come nearer, they had recourse from the skill and art of the pilots to the valor of the mountaineers. Our men, not having such expert seamen or skillful pilots, for they had been hastily drafted from the merchant ships, were not yet acquainted even with the names of the rigging, and were moreover impeded by the heaviness and slowness of our vessels, which, having been built in a hurry and of green timber, were not so easily maneuvered. Therefore, when my men had an opportunity of a close engagement, they cheerfully opposed two of the enemy's ships with one of theirs, and throwing in the grappling irons and holding both ships fast, we fought on both sides of the deck and boarded the enemy's, and having killed numbers of the Albici and shepherds, we sank some of their ships, took others with the men on board, and drove the rest into the harbor. That day the Massilians lost 9 ships, including those that were taken. When news of this battle was brought to me at Ilerda, the bridge being completed at the same time, fortune soon took a turn. The enemy, daunted by the courage of our horse, did not scour the country as freely or as boldly as before, but sometimes advanced a small distance from the camp, that they might have a ready retreat, and foraged within narrower bounds. At other times they took a longer circuit to avoid our outposts and parties of horse, or, having sustained some loss or spied our horse at a distance, they fled in the midst of their expedition, leaving their baggage behind them. After a while they resolved to leave off foraging for several days, and, contrary to the practice of all nations, to go out at night. In the meantime, the Oskenzis and the Kalaguritani, who were under the government of the Oskenzis, sent ambassadors to me, and offered to submit to my orders. They were followed by the Tarraconensis, Jacetani, and Ossetani, and in a few days more by the Ilurgavonensis, who dwelt near the river Ebro. I required of them all to assist me with providing corn, to which they agreed, and having collected all the cattle in the country, they conveyed them into my camp. One entire cohort of the Ilurgavonensis, knowing the design of their state, came over to me from the place where they were stationed, and carried their colors with them. A great change was shortly made in the face of affairs. The bridge being finished, 5 powerful states being joined to me, a way opened for the receiving of corn, and the rumors of the assistance of legions which were said to be on their march, with Pompey at their head through Mauritania, having died away, several of the more distant states revolted from Afranius and entered into league with me. The spirits of the enemy were dismayed at these things, so that I might not always be obliged to send my horse a long circuit around by the bridge, and having found a convenient place, I began to sink several drains, 30 feet deep, by which I might draw off a part of the river Segre and make a ford over it. When these were almost finished, Afranius and Petreius began to be greatly alarmed, lest they should be altogether cut off from corn and forage, because I was very strong in cavalry. They therefore resolved to quit their posts, and to transfer the war to Celtiberia. There was, moreover, a circumstance that confirmed them in this resolution, for of the 2 adverse parties, that which had stood by Sertorius in the late war, being conquered by Pompey, still trembled at his name and sway, though absent. The other, which had remained firm in Pompey's interest, loved him for the favors which they had received. But my name was not known to the barbarians. From these they expected considerable aid, both of horse and foot, and hoped to extend the war till winter, in a friendly country. Having come to this resolution, they gave orders to collect all the ships in the river Ebro, and to bring them to Octogesa, the town situated on the river Ebro, about 20 miles distant from their camp. At this part of the river they ordered a bridge to be made of boats fastened together, and transported 2 legions over the river Segre, and fortified their camp with a rampart 12 feet high. Notice of this being given by my scouts, I continued my work day and night, with very great fatigue to the soldiers, to drain the river, and so far effected my purpose that the horse were both able and bold enough, though with some difficulty and danger, to pass the river. But the foot had only their shoulders and upper part of their breast above the water, so that their fording it was slowed, not only by the depth of the water, but also by the speed of the current. However, almost at the same instant, news was received of the bridge being nearly completed over the Ebro, and a ford was found in the Segre. Now, for sure, the enemy began to think that they ought to hasten their march. Accordingly, leaving two auxiliary cohorts in the garrison at Ilerda, they crossed the Segre with their whole force, and formed one camp with the two legions which they had led across a few days before. I had no resource but to annoy and cut down their rear, since with my cavalry to go by the bridge required me to take a long circuit, so that they would arrive at the Ebro by a much shorter route. The horsemen which I had detached crossed the ford, and when Afranius and Petraeus had broken up their camp about the third watch, we suddenly appeared on their rear, and spreading around them in great numbers, slowed and impeded their march. At daybreak it was perceived from the rising grounds which joined my camp that their rear was vigorously pressed by our horse, that the last line sometimes halted and was broken. At other times that they joined battle and that our men were beaten back by a general charge of their cohorts, and in their turn pursued them when they wheeled about. But through the whole camp the soldiers gathered in parties, and declared their chagrin that the enemy had been suffered to escape from their hands, and that the war had been unnecessarily protracted. They applied to their tribunes and centurions, and entreated them to inform me that I need not spare their labor or consider their danger, that they were ready and able, and would venture to ford the river where the horse had crossed. Encouraged by their zeal and importunity, though I felt reluctant to expose my army to a river so exceedingly large, I still judged it prudent to attempt it and make a trial. Accordingly, I ordered all the weaker soldiers, whose spirit or strength seemed unequal to the fatigue, to be selected from each century, and left them, with one legion too, to guard the camp. The rest of the legions I drew out without any baggage, and having disposed a great number of horses in the river, above and below the ford I led my army over. A few of my soldiers, being carried away by the force of the current, were stopped by the horse and taken up. Not a man perished. My army being safe on the opposite bank, I drew out my forces and resolved to lead them forward in three battalions. And so great was the passion of the soldiers, that notwithstanding the addition of a circuit of 6 miles, and a considerable delay in fording the river, before the 9th hour of the day they came up with those who had set out at the third watch. When Afranius, who was in company with Petraeus, saw us at a distance, being afraid at so unexpected a sight, he halted on a rising ground and drew up his army. I refreshed my army on the plain, so I might not expose them to battle while fatigued. And when the enemy attempted to renew their march, I pursued and stopped them. They were obliged to pitch their camp sooner than they had intended, for there were mountains at a small distance, and difficult and narrow roads awaited them about 5 miles off. They retired behind these mountains that they might avoid my cavalry, and placing parties in the narrow roads, stop the progress of my army, and lead their own forces across the Ebro without danger or apprehension. It was in their interest to attempt this, and accomplish it by any means possible. But, fatigued by the skirmishes all day, and by the labor of their march, they deferred it until the following day. I likewise encamped on the next hill. About midnight, a few of their men who had gone some distance from the camp to fetch water were taken by our horsemen. I was informed by them that the generals of the enemy were drawing their troops out of the camp without noise. With this information I ordered the signal to be given, and the military shout to be raised for packing up the baggage. And when they heard the shout, being afraid lest they should be stopped in the night and obliged to engage under their baggage, or lest they should be confined in the narrow roads by my horsemen, they put a stop to their march and kept their forces in their camp. The next day Petraeus went out privately with a few horse to reconnoiter the country. A similar movement was made from my camp. Lucius Decidius Saxa was detached with a small party to explore the nature of the country. Each returned with the same account to their camp, that there was a level road for the next 5 miles, that there then came a rough and mountainous country. Whichever should first obtain possession of the defiles would have no trouble in preventing the other's progress. There was a debate in the council between Afranius and Petraeus, and the time of marching was the subject. The majority were of opinion that they should begin their march at night, so they might reach the defiles before they should be discovered. Others, because a shout had been raised the night before in my camp, used this as an argument that they could not leave the camp unnoticed, that my cavalry were patrolling the whole night, and that all the ways and roads were beset, that battles at night ought to be avoided, because in civil dissension a soldier once daunted is more apt to consult his fears than his oath, that the daylight raised a strong sense of shame in the eyes of all, and that the presence of the tribunes and centurions had the same effect. By these things the soldiers would be restrained and awed to their duty. Therefore they should by all means attempt to force their way by day, because, though a trifling loss might be sustained, yet the post which they desired might be secured with safety to the main body of the army. This opinion prevailed in the council, and the next day, at dawn, they resolved to set forward. Having taken a view of the country, the moment the sky began to grow white, I led my forces from the camp and marched at the head of my army by a long circuit, keeping to no regular road. The road which led to the Ebro and Octogesa was occupied by the enemy's camp, which lay in my way. My soldiers were obliged to cross extensive and difficult valleys. Craggy cliffs in several places interrupted their march, to the extent that their arms had to be handed to one another, and the soldiers were forced to perform a great part of their march unarmed, and were lifted up the rocks by each other. But not a man murmured at the fatigue, because they imagined that there would be a relief to all their toils if they could cut off the enemy from the Ebro and intercept their convoys. At first, Afranius's soldiers ran in high spirits from their camp to look at us, and in insulting language upbraided us that we were forced for lack of necessary subsistence to run away and return to Ilerda. Our route was different from what we proposed, and we appeared to be going a contrary way, but their generals applauded their own prudence in keeping within their camp, and it was a strong confirmation of their opinion that they saw we marched without wagons or baggage, which made them confident that we could not long endure shortages. But when they saw our army gradually wheel to the right, and observed our van was already passing the line of their camp, there was nobody so stupid or averse to fatigue as not to think it necessary to march from the camp immediately and oppose us. The cry to arms was raised, and all the army, except a few which were left to guard the camp, set out and marched the direct road to the Ebro. The contest depended entirely on dispatch, which should first get possession of the defile and the mountains. The difficulty of the roads delayed my army, but my cavalry, pursuing Afranius's forces, slowed the march. However, the affair was necessarily reduced to this point, with respect to Afranius's men, that if they first gained the mountains, which they desired, they would themselves avoid all danger, but could not save the baggage of their whole army, nor the cohorts which they had left behind in the camps, to which, being intercepted by my army, by no means could assistance be given. I accomplished the march first, and having found a plain behind large rocks, drew up my army there in order of battle and faced the enemy. Afranius, perceiving that his rear was galled by our cavalry, and seeing the enemy before him, having come to a hill, he made a halt on it. From there he dispatched 4 cohorts of Spanish light infantry to the highest mountain, which was in view. To this he ordered them to hasten with all expedition, and to take possession of it, with the intention of going to the same place with all his forces, then altering his route, and crossing the hills to Octoguesa. As the Spaniards were making toward it in an oblique direction, my horsemen sighted them and attacked them. They weren't able to withstand the charge of the cavalry even for a moment, but were all surrounded and cut to pieces in the sight of the two armies. There was now an opportunity for managing affairs successfully. It didn't escape me that an army daunted at suffering such a loss before their eyes could not stand, especially as they were surrounded by our horsemen, and the engagement would take place on even and open ground. To this I was importuned on all sides. The lieutenants, centurions, and tribunes gathered around me and begged that I would not hesitate to begin the battle, that the hearts of all the soldiers were very anxious for it, that Afranius's men had by several circumstances betrayed signs of fear, in that they had not assisted their party, in that they had not quit the hill, in that they did not sustain the charge of our cavalry, but crowding their standards into one place, did not observe either rank nor order. But if there were any apprehensions from the disadvantage of the ground, that an opportunity would be given of coming to battle in some other place, for Afranius must certainly come down, and would not be able to remain there for lack of water. I had conceived hopes of ending the affair without an engagement, or without striking a blow, because I'd cut off the enemy's supplies. Why should I hazard the loss of any of my men, even in a successful battle? Why should I expose soldiers to be wounded, who had deserved so well of me? Why, in short, should I tempt fortune, especially when it was as much a general's duty to conquer by tactics as by the sword? Besides, I was moved with compassion for those citizens, who I knew beforehand must fall, and I'd rather gain my object without any loss or injury to them. This resolution of mine was not generally approved of, but the soldiers openly declared to each other that since such an opportunity of victory was let pass, they would not come to an engagement, even when I should wish it. I persevered, however, in my resolution, and retired a little from that place to abate the enemy's fears. Petraeus and Afranius, having got this opportunity, retired to their camp. Having dispatched parties on the mountains and cut off all access to the Ebro, I fortified my camp as close to the enemy as I could. The next day, the generals of my opponents, being alarmed that they had lost all prospects of supplies and of access to the Ebro, consulted about what other course they should take. There were two roads, one to Ilerda if they chose to return, the other to Tarraco if they should march to it. While they were deliberating on these matters, intelligence was brought to them that their watering parties were attacked by our horsemen. On that information, they disposed several parties of horse and auxiliary foot along the road, mixing some legionary cohorts, and began to throw up a rampart from the camp to the water, that they might be able to procure water within their lines, both without fear and without a guard. Petraeus and Afranius divided this task between themselves, and went in person some distance from their camp for the purpose of seeing it accomplished. The soldiers, having obtained by their absence a free opportunity of conversing with each other, came out in great numbers, and asked each for whatever acquaintance or fellow citizen he had in our camp, and invited him to him. First they returned them general thanks for sparing them the day before, when they were greatly terrified, and acknowledged that they were alive through their kindness, that they inquired about my honor, and whether they could with safety entrust themselves to me, and declared their sorrow that they had not done so in the beginning, and that they had taken up arms against their relations and kinsmen. Encouraged by these conferences, they desired my parole for the lives of Petraeus and Afranius, that they might not appear guilty of a crime in having betrayed their generals. When they were assured of obtaining their demands, they promised that they would immediately remove their standards, and sent centurions of the first rank as deputies to treat with me about a peace. In the meantime, some of them invited their acquaintances and brought them to their camp. Others were brought away by their friends, so that the two camps seemed to be united into one, and several of the tribunes and centurions came to me and paid their respects to me. The same was done by some of the nobility of Spain, who they summoned to their assistance, and kept in their camp as hostages. They asked after their acquaintances and friends by whom each might have the means of being recommended to me. Even Afranius's son, a young man, endeavored by means of Sulpicius the lieutenant to make terms for his own and his father's life. Every place was filled with mirth and congratulations, in the one army because they thought they had escaped so impending a danger, in the other because they thought they had completed so important a matter without blows. And I, in every man's judgment, reaped the advantage of my former lenity, and my conduct was applauded by all. When these circumstances were announced to Afranius, he left the work which he had begun, and returned to his camp, determined, as it appeared, whatever should be the event, to bear it with an even and steady mind. Petreius did not neglect himself. He armed his domestics. With them and the praetorian cohort of Spaniards, and a few foreign horsemen, his dependents, who he commonly kept near him to guard his person, he suddenly flew to the rampart, interrupted the conferences of the soldiers, drove our men from the camp, and put to death as many as he caught. The rest formed into a body, and being alarmed by the unexpected danger, wrapped their left arms in their cloaks, and drew their swords, and in this manner, depending on the nearness of the camp, defended themselves against the Spaniards and the horse, and made good their retreat to the camp, where they were protected by the cohorts which were on guard. Petreius, after accomplishing this, went around every maniple, calling the soldiers by their names and entreating with tears that they would not give him up or their absent general Pompey as a sacrifice to the vengeance of their enemies. Immediately they ran in crowds to the general's pavilion, when he required them all to take an oath that they would not desert nor betray the army nor the generals, nor form any design distinct from the general interest. He himself swore first to the tenor of those words, and obliged Afranius to take the same oath. The tribunes and centurions followed their example. The soldiers were brought out by centuries and took the same oath. They gave orders that whoever had any of my soldiers should produce them. As soon as they were produced, they put them to death publicly in the praetorium, but most of them concealed those that they had entertained and let them out at night over the rampart. Thus the terror raised by the generals, the cruelty of the punishments, the new obligation of an oath, removed all hopes of surrender for the present, changed the soldiers' minds, and reduced matters to the former state of war. I ordered the enemy's soldiers who had come into my camp to hold a conference, to be searched for with the strictest diligence, and sent back. But of the tribunes and centurions, several voluntarily remained with me, and I afterward treated them with great respect. The centurions I promoted to higher ranks, and conferred on the Roman knights the honor of tribunes. Afranius's men were distressed with foraging and procured water with difficulty. The legionary soldiers had a tolerable supply of corn, because they had been ordered to bring from Ilerda enough to last 22 days. The Spanish and auxiliary forces had none, for they had but few opportunities of procuring any, and their bodies were not accustomed to bear burdens. And therefore a great number of them came over to me every day. Their affairs were under these difficulties, but of the two schemes proposed, the most expedient seemed to be to return to Ilerda, because they had left some corn there, and there they hoped to decide on a plan for their future conduct. Tarraco lay at a greater distance, and in such a space they knew affairs might admit of many changes. Their design having met with approbation, they set out from their camp. Having sent forward my cavalry to annoy and slow their rear, I followed close after with my legions. Not a moment passed in which their rear was not engaged with our horsemen. Their manner of fighting was this. The light cohorts closed their rear, and frequently made a stand on the level grounds. If they had a mountain to ascend, the very nature of the place readily secured them from any danger, for the advanced guards from the rising grounds protected the rest in their ascent. When they approached a valley or declivity, and the advanced men could not impart assistance to the tardy, our horse threw their darts at them from the rising grounds with advantage. Then their affairs were in a perilous situation. The only plan left was that whenever they came near such places, they should give orders to the legions to halt, and by a violent effort repulse our horsemen, and they, being forced to give way, they should suddenly, with the utmost speed, run all together down to the valley, and having passed it, should face about again on the next hill. So far were they from deriving any assistance from their horse, of which they had a large number, that they were obliged to receive them into the center of their army, and themselves protect them, as they were daunted by former battles. And on their march no one could quit the line without being taken by my horsemen. While skirmishes were fought in this manner, they advanced only slowly and gradually, and frequently halted to help their rear, as then happened. For having advanced 4 miles, and being very much harassed by our horse, they took post in a high mountain, and there entrenched themselves on the front only, facing the enemy, and did not take their baggage off their cattle. When they perceived that my camp was pitched, and the tents fixed up, and my horse sent out to forage, they suddenly rushed out about 12 o'clock the same day. Having hopes that we should be delayed by the absence of our horse, they began to march. I perceived this, and followed them with the legions that remained. I left a few cohorts to guard my baggage, and ordered the foragers to be called home at the 10th hour, and the horse to follow me. The horse shortly returned to their daily duty on march, and charged the rear so vigorously that they almost forced them to fly, and several privates and some centurions were killed. The main body of my army was at hand, and universal ruin threatened them. Then, not having opportunity either to choose a convenient position for their camp or to march forward, they were obliged to halt and to encamp at a distance from water and on ground naturally unfavorable. But for the reasons already given, I did not attack them, nor suffer a tent to be pitched that day, that my men might be the readier to pursue them whether they attempted to run off by night or by day. Observing the defect in their position, they spent the whole night extending their work and turning their camp towards ours. The next day, at dawn, they did the same, and spent the whole day in that manner. But in proportion as they advanced their works and extended their camp, they were further distant from the water, and one evil was remedied by another. The first night no one went out for water. The next day they left a guard in the camp and led out all their forces to water, but not a person was sent to look for forage. I was more desirous that they should be humbled by these means and forced to come to terms than decide the contest by battle. Yet I endeavored to surround them with a wall and trench that I might be able to check their most recent sally, to which I imagined that they must have recourse. At this point, urged by a shortage of fodder, so that they might be the readier for a march, they killed all their baggage cattle. In this labor and the deliberations on it, 2 days were spent. By the third day, a considerable part of my work was finished. To interrupt my progress, they drew out their legions about the 8th hour, by a certain signal, and placed them in order of battle before their camp. I called my legions off from their work, and ordering the horse to hold themselves in readiness, marshaled my army. To appear to decline an engagement contrary to the opinion of the soldiers and the general voice would have been attended with great disadvantage. But for the reasons already known, I was dissuaded from wishing to engage, especially because the short space between the camps, even if the enemy were put to flight, would not contribute much to a decisive victory, for the two camps were not distant from each other more than 2,000 feet. Two parts of this were occupied by the armies, and one-third left for the soldiers to charge and make their attack. If a battle should be begun, the nearness of the camps would afford a ready retreat to the conquered party in the flight. For this reason, I had resolved to resist if they attacked me, but not to be the first to provoke the battle. Afranius's five legions were drawn up in two lines. The auxiliary cohorts formed the third line and acted as reserves. I had three lines and four cohorts out of each of the five legions form the first line. Three more from each legion followed them as reserves, and three others were behind these. The slingers and archers were stationed in the center of the line. The cavalry closed the flanks. The hostile armies being arranged in this manner, each seemed determined to adhere to my first intention, for me not to hazard a battle unless forced to it, and Afranius to interrupt my works. However, the matter was deferred, and both armies kept under arms till sunset, when they both returned to their camp. The next day I prepared to finish the works which I had begun. The enemy attempted to pass the river Segre by a ford. Having perceived this, I sent some light-armed Germans and a party of horse across the river and dispatched several parties along the banks to guard them. At length, beset on all sides, their cattle having been 4 days without fodder, and having no water, wood, or corn, they begged for a conference, if possible, in a place remote from the soldiers. When I refused this, but offered a public interview instead if they chose it, Afranius's son was given as a hostage to me. We met in the place I appointed. In front of both armies, Afranius said that I ought not to be displeased either with him or his soldiers for wishing to preserve their attachment to their general, Cneius Pompey, that they had now sufficiently discharged their duty to him and had suffered punishment enough in having endured the shortage of every necessity. But now, pent up almost like wild beasts, they were prevented from procuring water, and prevented from walking abroad, and were not able to bear the bodily pain or the mental disgrace, but confessed themselves vanquished, and begged and entreated me, if there was any room left for mercy, that they should not be necessitated to suffer the most severe penalties. These sentiments were delivered in the most submissive and humble language. I replied that either to complain or sue for mercy became no man less than him, for every other person had done their duty. In having declined to engage on favorable terms in an advantageous situation and time, that all things tending to a peace might be totally unembarrassed, my army, in having preserved and protected the men who they had in their power, notwithstanding the injuries which they had received, and the murder of comrades, and even Afranius's soldiers, who of themselves treated about concluding a peace, by which they thought that they would secure the lives of all. Thus, that the parties on both sides inclined to mercy, that the generals only were averse to peace, that they paid no regard to the laws either of conference or truce, and had most inhumanly put to death ignorant persons who were deceived by a conference, that, therefore, they had met that fate which usually befalls men from excessive obstinacy and arrogance, and were obliged to have recourse, and most earnestly desire from which they had shortly before disdained. For my part, I would not avail myself of their present humiliation, or my present advantage, to require terms by which my power might be increased, but only that those armies which they had maintained for so many years to oppose me should be disbanded. For 6 legions had been sent into Spain, and a 7th raised there, and many and powerful fleets provided, and generals of great military experience sent to command them, for no other purpose than to oppose me. That none of these measures were adopted to keep the Spains in peace, or for the use of the province, which from the length of the peace stood in need of no such aid. That all these things were long since designed against me. Against me a new sort of government was established, that the same person should be at the gates of Rome to direct the affairs of the city, and though absent, have the government of two very warlike provinces for so many years, that against me the laws of the magistrates had been altered, that the late praetors and consuls should not be sent to govern the provinces, as had been the constant custom, but persons approved of and chosen by a faction, that against me the excuse of age was not admitted, but persons of tried experience in former wars were called up to take the command of the armies, that with respect to me only, the routine was not observed which had been allowed to all generals, that after a successful war they should return home and disband their armies, if not with some mark of honor, at least without disgrace, that I had submitted to all these things patiently, and would still submit to them. Nor did I now desire to take their army from them and keep it for myself, which, however, would not be a difficult matter, but only that they should not have it to employ against me. And therefore, as I said before, they should quit the provinces and disband their army. If this was complied with, I would injure no one. These were the last and only conditions of peace. It was very acceptable and agreeable to Afranius's soldiers, as might be easily known from their signs of joy, that they who expected some injury after this defeat should obtain without solicitation the reward of a dismissal. When a debate was introduced about the place and time of their dismissal, they all began to express both by words and signs from the rampart where they stood that they should be discharged immediately. For, although every security might be given that they would be disbanded, still the matter would be uncertain if it was deferred to a future day. After a short debate on either side, it was brought to this issue, that those who had any settlement or possession in Spain should be immediately discharged, the rest at the River Var. I gave security that they should receive no damage, and that no person should be obliged against my inclination to take the military oath under me. I promised to supply them with corn until they arrived at the River Var. I further added that whatever any of them lost in the war which was in the possession of my soldiers should be restored to those that lost them. To my soldiers I made a recompense in money for those things, a just valuation being made. Whatever disputes Afranius's soldiers had afterward among themselves, they voluntarily submitted to my decision. Afranius and Petreius, when pay was demanded by the legions, a sedition almost breaking out, asserted that the time had not yet come, and required that I should take cognizance of it, and both parties were content with my decision. About a third of their army being dismissed in 2 days, I ordered two of my legions to go first, the rest to follow the vanquished enemy, that they should encamp at a small distance from each other. The execution of this business I assigned to Quintus Fufius Calenus, one of my lieutenants. According to my directions, they marched from Spain to the River Var, and there the rest of the army was disbanded. Book 2. While these things were going forward in Spain, Caius Trebonius, my lieutenant, who had been left to conduct the assault of Massilia, began to raise a mound, vineae, and turrets against the town on 2 sides, one of which was next to the harbor and docks, the other on that part where there is a passage from Gaul and Spain to that sea which forces itself up the mouth of the Rhone. Massilia is washed almost on 3 sides by the sea, the remaining 4th part the only side which has access by land. A part of even this space which reaches to the fortress, being fortified by the nature of the country, and a very deep valley, required a long and difficult siege. To accomplish these works, Caius Trebonius sent for a great quantity of carriages and men from the whole province, and ordered hurdles and materials to be furnished. These things being provided, he raised a mound 80 feet high. But so great a supply of everything necessary for a war had been a long time before gathered in the town, and so great a number of engines that no vignette made of hurdles could withstand their force. For poles 12 feet in height, pointed with iron, and these two shot from very large engines, sank into the ground through 4 rows of hurdles. Therefore, the arches of the vignette were covered over with beams 1 foot thick, fastened together, and under this the material